Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky, sitting in for Ira Flatow, and I just want to start by telling you, Ira is fine. He's just spending a week at home instead of his planned trip to watch baseball spring training. Don't worry, he will be back next week, and hopefully baseball will be back soon too. Later this hour, we'll be talking with Jane Goodall. This year marks the 60th anniversary of chimp research in the Gombe. But first, Americans are being told that we're living in a new normal. Social distancing, vigilant hygiene, restrictions placed on schools and businesses that will be part of our lives for quite a while. We're also hearing that the world will be different after coronavirus, that the fabric of our society will forever be changed, and we may be starting to see some of those changes play out right now. Here to bring us some of the stories of this new reality is Sophie Bushwick. She's tech editor for Scientific American. Sophie, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
First of all, let's address the news coming out this week that people with mild or asymptomatic cases of this novel coronavirus are doing more to spread the disease than scientists first thought. So explain this to us.
So earlier this month, health officials were saying that they thought the majority of the spread of coronavirus was coming from people who were already showing visible symptoms. They were maybe coughing and thus spraying spit that had viruses in it on their surroundings and other issues like that. But more and more studies have been coming out that suggest actually people with no symptoms at all could be spreading the virus. In fact, some people who were infected with the virus and not yet showing symptoms had what's called a higher viral load. That means there's more, they produce, so for example, if someone were to cough and to have a droplet of saliva go, the droplet of saliva from somebody who's not showing symptoms would have more viruses in it than a droplet of saliva from someone who is showing symptoms.
Mm. So this is pretty scary. Do these people go on to have more serious symptoms later on, though?
Some of them do, some of them don't. Some of them, so for what we do know is that a lot of people who get infected when they're first can be tested for the virus, they might not necessarily be showing any symptoms of it. Some of them later go on to develop mild or severe symptoms. And in other cases, somebody might not realize that they could have a case so mild they wouldn't even realize that they had been infected. But they do know that there's at least one outbreak that they trace to people who were infected but didn't have any visible symptoms.
So this is a lot more evidence, it seems, for social distancing. Even if you're not sick and you don't know if someone is sick when you're near them, you know, this is really something that we have to take seriously, even more so than we thought before.
Absolutely. I think that one thing that officials have said is the way to think about social distancing is not that you're trying to avoid getting sick yourself, but assume that you have it and then you're trying to keep other people safe.
Oh, okay. So there's one scary story. I promise, Sophie, we're going to get to at least one story that's not incredibly frightening today. But let's go to another scary news story here. Hospital respirators are in short supply in Italy. We know about that. But we may soon be seeing the same problem here in the U.S. Tell me more.
Right. So hospitals in the United States have a limited number of intensive care unit beds, ICU beds, that are used to treat severely sick patients, and they have a limited number of ventilators. So one thing that can happen in severe cases of COVID-19 and pneumonia is that the people who are sick need to be put on a ventilator that will breathe for them because their own lungs can't do the job. The problem is New York and other states across the country have a limited number of ventilators currently being used. And the worry is that we're going to have more patients than ventilators soon, which is going to make force healthcare workers to make these awful life and death decisions about who gets life-saving technology.
And, of course, those are decisions nobody wants to have to make. But the numbers here are really staggering. 18,000 ventilators could be needed in a place like New York City. And how many are That's available right. now?
Well, there are fewer than 10,000 currently in New York. And the problem is many of them are actually in use. So they're not necessarily, even though that count is, you know, there's thousands of them, many of them are actually being used right now. And so you can't just take a patient off of one of those ventilators to give it to a COVID-19 patient. They think they could be short by 16,000 ventilators, which is very scary.
So whenever we're talking about flattening the curve, right, this is how we keep a shortage like this from happening.
Exactly. This is exactly what people are talking about with flattening the curve. The idea is you want to have fewer people at any given time needing these machines, needing a bed in an ICU, and needing professional care from doctors and nurses and other workers who are relying on personal protective equipment like masks and gowns that may soon be in short supply.
Okay, so there's also news this week that the government is in talks to use anonymous cell phone location data to help better understand how coronavirus is spreading. Tell us more about what they're trying to do here.
So what they're talking about is, so there's two different kinds of things people think about when they're talking about tracking the location of your smartphone. So this is a case where they would use the location data from people's smartphones to just build up a picture of how people move around certain areas of a city or even of the country. So this isn't a case of Big Brother following you individually around to see who you've interacted with. Instead, when researchers are building models of how viruses spread and trying to figure out how quickly they spread, it helps to know, you know, what the foot traffic might be like in Times Square on a given day. So they could say, well, let's assume that people follow these walking patterns. What would happen if one of the people walking through here was carrying, was infected with coronavirus and potentially spreading it? How would that simulation look? How would that same simulation look if you assume you've got 10 people or 100 people on a given day? So this is just helping researchers better track how quickly cases are going to increase and how quickly this virus is going to spread. That's the specific application they're looking at. Now, on the other hand, other countries are using more individual data, and what they're trying to do is, for example, some companies even here have talked about potentially developing an app that could tell you, hey, you were in proximity to someone who is known to be infected with coronavirus on X day. Here's what you should do about it. Maybe they should tell the person that they need to quarantine themselves or that they need to warn their own contacts to get tested.
So this is something that China is trying right now. I've been reading that Israel is doing something like this. I assume
right.
that privacy experts are pretty scared about this idea, though.
Correct. So the idea of using anonymized data, privacy experts are more on board for that because you're not tracking any individual person. The idea of this other app, it really opens up some scary implications because what if the government decided to prosecute you for going on a walk if you were infected? It just opens up the door to even more privacy invasions, and it also opens up the door to an application that maybe people could keep using after the coronavirus crisis passes.
Okay, one more scary story here. Reports of a lot of bad actors out there using the fear of coronavirus now to spread malware and perform phishing attacks on people, like spreading another type of virus. What's happening?
Right. So in this case, it's a digital virus that you want to avoid being infected with. So the idea, there's a couple different things going on. One is some bad actors are sending out emails that claim to be maybe with health alerts. They might include a link that looks like it goes to the CDC website, but in fact redirects you to a website that's going to try to steal your information or download software. Other cases are phishing attacks where it might direct you to a website where it says, here's some important health information. Sign in using certain credentials, using maybe your email password. You want to avoid those websites as well. And then another thing that's going on is Johns Hopkins has developed a map that maps the spread of coronavirus in real time.
It's
a really helpful tool. However, what hackers have done is they've taken that map and they're using it to lure people to other websites. So they might say, here's a link to the map, and you click the link, and then that website might tell you, before you view the map, you need to download this software, and then that software would infect your computer. So if you're looking for a map, please only go to the one on the Johns Hopkins website. That one is safe. And in general, just be cautious about downloading software from unknown websites and about entering your credentials in unknown websites. Be careful about clicking links in your emails, even if those emails claim to be about health information.
Okay, so something else we're hearing a lot about is deep cleaning. Planes are getting deep cleaned. Cruise ships are being deep cleaned. Even offices are right now. I don't know, Sophie, what does deep cleaning really mean right now?
Okay, so deep cleaning is one of those terms that can mean different things depending on who's saying it. When people say when organizations say they're doing deep cleaning, they mean they're doing very thorough cleaning, but there's not a specific formula that refers to. So some of the things that they're doing are pretty cool. For example, some airplanes have started using misting cabins or certain specific high traffic areas with this vapor of disinfectant to try to, you know, cover as many surfaces as they can. In other cases, deep cleaning means, so for things like cloth and carpets and soft surfaces, you can't clean that with disinfectant the way you can wipe off a harder surface. So in some cases, what that means is washing clothing and bedding in hotter water than would normally be used in an attempt to kill pathogens.
I mean, we've all had the experience that planes are pretty gross places to be. Why exactly weren't they doing this in the first place?
Right. I mean, if you ride a plane, whether now or later, if you're on a plane trip, I highly recommend that you bring disinfecting wipes and wipe down the area around you and anything you might touch, because, yes, those things on a typically do not get cleaned as often simply because there's just not time. So a lot of times a plane lands at an airport, the passengers disembark, and they need to load the plane right back up. So they've got a limited amount of time, and they're going to focus their cleaning efforts on high traffic areas. They're going to try cleaning the restrooms. They're going to try cleaning things that get touched a lot, like handles and knobs. And they're not necessarily going to have time to clean the tray on your seat back.
Yeah, I would guess not. Hey, Sophie, before I let you go, we have a little bit less than a minute left. People are trying to escape from this terrible thing that we're all stuck in right now, and they're escaping by actually watching movies and playing games about pandemics. What's going on?
Right. So there's been a surge in popularity for things like the movie Contagion, which is about a fictional pandemic, and for games in which you play a member of a public health team fighting against a pandemic. One game called Plague Inc., people actually crashed the website trying to download it. And so what could be going on here is, psychologically, it feels good to think that you are taking action and doing something instead of being helpless. And these games and media help people do that.
Sophie Bushwick is tech editor for Scientific American. Sophie, thanks so much for the update, and stay safe out there if you would, please.
I will. You too.
When we come back, Jane Goodall joins us to talk about her work with the chimps and her work today encouraging hope and conservation around the world. Stay with us.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. 60 years ago this year, researchers began a project observing the behavior of wild chimpanzees in the Gombe. One of these researchers was a young Jane Goodall, who would go on to document tool use among the chimps and change our perceptions of the animal world. 60 years on now, Dr. Jane Goodall is a global conservationist. She's founder of the Jane Goodall Institute and UN Messenger of Peace. Dr. Jane Goodall, thanks so much for joining us, and it's good to speak with you once again. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, good to speak with you, too. But by the way, when I went out to Gombe, it wasn't a group of researchers. It was me alone.
Well, yeah, I guess that's right. So a group of researchers versus you alone. Tell us about that. Take us back to that time, if you would.
Well, yeah, it's actually, you know, it's very easy for me to remember going along the lake shore and looking up at the hills. It's very steep. It's a series of valleys running down into Lake Tanganyika, and looking there and thinking, how am I ever going to find the chimpanzees? But then, having dreamed about being in the wild with animals since I was 10, once we got the tent up, I climbed up a little way. It was getting towards evening, and I sat there, and there were baboons barking and birds singing and looking out at the lake, and it was just the most incredible. Like, you know, my dream has actually come true.
That must be an amazing feeling when your dream as a young girl comes true. What do you remember about that time when you actually realized, my goodness, I'm going to have chimpanzees surrounding me?
Well, it wasn't like that at first. They would take one look and run away. It took 6 months before I could sit calmly with chimps around me. But luckily, after 4 months, one of them, David Greybeard, I named him, he was the one who began to lose his fear, and he was the one who showed me chimps using and making tools, something that then it was thought that only humans did.
That initial observation of tool use, is that still the most important thing that you think we learned from your research?
No, I don't actually. I think the most important thing is, you know, when I went to Cambridge after 2 years, I hadn't been to college before, but I'd been with the chimps 2 years. And I was nervous, and the professors told me that I shouldn't have named the chimpanzees. They should have had numbers. I couldn't talk about personality, mind, or emotion because those were unique to us. But I had this wonderful teacher as a child who taught me that wasn't true, and that was my dog. And because chimpanzees are so biologically like us, and because by this time my to-be husband had been taking photographs and filming, science had to change this reductionist way of thinking and realize we're part of and not separated from the rest of the animal kingdom.
Hmm. What do you think researchers have learned from watching these chimp families in all these lineages, in all these years after you first spent time there?
Yeah, we're just into the fourth generation, and you know, through DNA analysis, we now know who the fathers are. So one of the things that fascinates me is there's good and bad chimp mothers, just as in human society. And I was lucky in having a good, supportive mother. She supported this crazy dream when everybody else laughed at me. And so we find that looking back over 60 years, typically the offspring of the good supportive mothers do better. The males reach a higher position in the hierarchy, probably sire more infants, and the females are better mothers.
Well, what's a good chimp mother like? I mean, what's the behavior that characterizes a good mother from a bad mother in that world?
In chimp or human?
Well, I think we can all assume what we know a bit about humans, but tell us about it in the chimp world.
Well, it's exactly the same as in the human world, you see. And that is that the good mother will be protective but not overprotective. She'll be playful. She'll be attentive. She'll always run to support her child, even if that child has got in a squabble with the infant of a higher-ranking female and the mother knows that she's going to get beaten up. She will still go to the support of her child. And you know, I've learned from the chimps that what is really important for us is for the child to have to be surrounded by up to three adults who are consistently there for the child and make the child feel secure. And even if it's not the biological parents, as long as there is that small group of support around the child, that gives them a really good start. And it's the same for chimps.
We're talking with Dr. Jane Goodall, and you can tweet at us, at SciFry, if you have some thoughts or ideas for her. Do you ever think about the fact that someone else may have done this? If you hadn't have gone out to the Gombe 60 years ago, that someone else may have seen this behavior? Do you think that they would have had the same experiences, learned the same things?
Well, I presume so. I mean, if they'd gone to Gombe, but we know now that chimpanzees in different parts of Africa behave in different ways. They actually have cultures, which the young ones learn by observing the adults. And chimps like us have a long childhood, and I think that's important because they have an awful lot to learn.
Do you ever think the world would have been different, or the world of this research would have been different, if you would have looked at some other form of African wildlife, you know, giraffes, for instance? I mean, is there something very specific that we learned because we studied chimpanzees, because they're so close to us? Or do you ever think about the idea that you could have gone off on another quest to I don't know, search for elephants?
Yeah, well, I would have. I mean, I would have studied any animal in Africa. It was Louis Leakey who wanted me to study the chimpanzees. And I think the importance of that was that I had not been to university. I hadn't been taught, you know, that there was a difference in kind between us and other animals. And if I had been to university and scientists had tried to indoctrinate me in that way, I don't know if I would have been the same or different. But Louis Leakey pounced on this mind, as he called it, uncluttered with reductionist scientific thinking. So, you know, I went and watched the chimpanzees. I came to recognize them. I could see their different personalities. You can see their emotions of happiness, sadness, fear, despair. It's, you know, it's more or less the same as us. And because of that, because science began to change, it had to, then our relationship with the rest of the animal world has changed, and we now can study emotion and intelligence in creatures as different from us as the octopus.
Hmm. So much of your work now is about conservation. I guess I'll first ask, what do you think the world has learned about conservation from some of your African research?
Well, what I learned is that when I'd been in the field for about, well, up until from 60 to 86, that, you know, at a conference where different people by then were studying chimps, and it was very clear that chimp numbers were decreasing, forests were disappearing, and at Gombe, it's a very tiny national park, it was surrounded by 12 villages, and they were literally struggling to survive. Extreme poverty, overused soil, terrible soil erosion, where they cut down the trees on the steep slopes, which they had to do to try and survive. And so that's when it hit me. If we don't do something to improve their lives, help them find ways of living without destroying the environment, we can't possibly begin to save the chimps, to conserve the chimps, or go on studying the chimps. So the Jane Goodall Institute began our program, Dakari, Take Care, in those 12 villages. It's now in 104 villages throughout the whole chimp range in Tanzania and in six other African countries where we're studying chimpanzees. So, you know, the villages have now become our partners in conservation.
How much do you think the world, though, by and large, has changed in their views of conservation over all this time? It feels sometimes as though we take a step forward and then a big step back. What are your thoughts about 60 years of conservation in the world?
Well, it's not really 60 years, because when I began, there wasn't really this need for conservation. You know,
yeah.
There was an equatorial forest belt right across Africa. The Amazon was still wild and unknown. And so it sort of hit suddenly, this sudden need, the sudden realization that habitats were being destroyed as human populations grew, as the Western world got more greedy and wanted more and more stuff, as the economy works on businesses creating materials, goods that are going to be self-destructed in so many years, so that people go on buying and buying and wasting and wasting. You know, it's a vicious circle. And you can't, it's absurd to think you can have unlimited economic development in a planet with finite natural resources. So the battle of those of us who want to conserve the environment is huge, because we're up against the big companies, corrupt governments, corrupt business. And, you know, sometimes you think, well, how on earth are we ever going to make change, the change we must make, because we are part of the natural environment. We're not separated from it. We depend on forests for clean air and clean water, and forests and oceans for absorbing carbon dioxide, for example. But my biggest hope lies in the fact that we, in 1991, started our Roots and Shoots program, and it began with 12 high school students in Tanzania who were concerned about different things. It's now in it's in 65 countries. It's got hundreds and thousands of young people from kindergarten to university, and they all choose between them three projects. They choose one to help people, one to help animals, one to help the environment. So these projects differ depending on their age, the kind of environment they're in, if they're rich or poor, the country, the religion sometimes. So it's my greatest hope, because everywhere I go, there are young people wanting to tell Dr. Jane what they're doing to make the world a better place. Enthusiasm, excitement, determination.
I love that idea, though, of doing something for the animals, doing something for people, and doing something for the environment. So many activists, it seems, pick one of those three and focus all their efforts there, as opposed to saying we need to take care of all three of these things.
Yeah, we really do. And it's all, you know, see, I learned about the interconnectedness of everything out in the rainforest, where you learn that every species, no matter how small, has a role to play. And all of it is important if you want to maintain the biodiversity of the area, and that's what keeps the habitat healthy.
We're talking with Dr. Jane Goodall, a global conservationist, of course. She's the founder of the Jane Goodall Institute, and we're taking some of your tweets at SciFry. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. At the Davos Forum on Climate Change this year, you threw your support behind an effort called 1 Trillion Trees. It's aimed at widespread nature restoration. Can you tell us more about that and why you think it's so important?
Yes, well, that was it was Mark Benioff of Salesforce that got behind that and made it prominent. And the thing is that it's been apparently worked out that 1 trillion trees would be sufficient to absorb the excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And certainly planting trees is important. Protecting the existing forest is even more important. But planting trees, helping to restore degraded forest land. Planting trees in urban areas too, because that regulates the temperature of the city. It provides shade. But perhaps most important of all, it raises the comfort level of people, having green surrounding them.
Mm. There were a few of your comments at Davos that were a bit controversial. You said that the environmental problems we're dealing with wouldn't really be a problem if we had the global population we did 500 years ago. What did you mean by that statement?
Well, what I mean is that today it's said that we have 7.2 billion people on the planet. And already in many places, we're using up natural resources faster than nature can replenish them. And obviously, as poor countries get richer, they want the same standard of living as we have in the West. So, you know, on the one hand, we have our unsustainable lifestyles, and you have extreme poverty destroying the environment because you have to survive. But then it's predicted that in 2050, there will be 9.7 billion of us, all wanting better lifestyles. So how can the planet cope? So what I mean by it is, you know, as our numbers grow and as we make a real change in our mind attitude, and learn to live with much, much less and alleviate poverty so that the poor can also look after the environment. So I think you get the picture. It's just sheer simple fact. And one comment that I heard was that, oh, you know, Jane's blaming the southern world, India, Africa, because they have many children. But in fact, one child from a wealthy society will use up, I don't know, the numbers differ, but 10 times more, maybe slightly more, natural resources than a child in a poor community in Africa.
So as you said before, it's about that imbalance that the world of big businesses and corporations and the wealthiest use so many more resources than the poorest people in the southern part of the globe.
Yes, absolutely. And so it's really our fault, all this climate change. And yet the people who suffer are the people who really haven't contributed to it at all. It's extremely unfair. And hopefully our Roots and Shoots young people, they've all got the same attitude. They all know that things have to change. They're all getting ideas as to what to do about it. And they're very passionate, you know, about things like palm oil plantations and plastic and all those sort of things. And planting trees. We've guaranteed that our youth will plant 5 million trees this year.
And that's a pretty enormous number. We actually have some tweets coming in from some young people, and we'll get to some of those in just a moment. You can join our conversation at SciFry with Jane Goodall in just a moment. Please stay with us. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking this hour about global connectedness, conservation, and hope. My guest is Dr. Jane Goodall, founder of the Jane Goodall Institute and UN Messenger of Peace. We have some tweets coming in. John says, thanks to Dr. Goodall for all her conservation work. I use her advocacy for planting trees along farms adjacent to Gombe to help explain landscape corridors and conservation when teaching ecology principles. And James has a tweet. Says, our 9-year-old has been so inspired by your work. His dream is to work with and save orangutans. So what advice, Jane Goodall, do you have for him and his hopes?
Well, first of all, maybe he is part of Roots and Shoots, but if he isn't, find out how to become involved, because then he's with other young people who he'll find others who want to help orangutans, and they desperately need it. So my advice is to learn all that he can about them, not to give up his dream, and with Roots and Shoots, he can find ways to help them now.
Jane Goodall, you've lived through a lot of eras in the world in which things have been scary and times have changed. It seems very scary right now. I'm wondering if you can talk about how you feel about this particular moment in history as we're all huddled in our homes and unable to go outside and socialize.
Well, it is a very scary time. I'm not in a position to not socialize because it's quite a large family of us in this house. You know, I'm in the house where I grew up. It's a family home. But I think you know, you always look for some kind of silver lining in these situations. I remember the other time when I felt initially as horrified as now was with 9/11 when I was in New York, and that was a shocking time. And you know, it sort of had a paralyzing effect, not only in America, but around the world. This is actually affecting everyone. So the little silver lining is that it's reopened the discussion about our interaction with wild animals, the trafficking of them, the selling them for meat. People are blaming China for this virus, And yes, it did start with what they call a wet market in China. And so did SARS. That was another wet market in China. But HIV virus, that started in Africa with people eating chimpanzees and monkeys. And there was a terrible pandemic started from contact with cattle in a slaughterhouse in the United States. So we just have to rethink as we get closer and closer, particularly to wild animals. The viruses in them can do what they call cross the species barrier and jump into us. And it's usually from handling them from the blood, eating slightly uncooked meat and that sort of thing. There was another pandemic from camels in the Middle East. So it is really making us rethink our relationship with other animals.
It is, but even with these signals, do you have hope that we get the message this time around?
Well, China immediately banned all import and selling of wild animals in China and closed down all the meat markets. Hopefully, because this pandemic seems to be worse than the others, having more effect economically, that this ban will be made permanent and extended to the animals used in traditional Chinese medicine. But then we come to Africa. Well, until we eradicate poverty, it's going to be very hard to stop people handling wild animals in Africa because a lot of them depend on them for food. This is how all this interconnectedness of everything is really sometimes very, very challenging. And clearly I don't have the answers. I know what we should do, but I don't know how to get there.
Well, you've spent so much time studying the behavior of chimpanzees. I'm wondering, as we consider just the boundaries of society, what it means to be a society when we can't interact in the way we once have, do you think that there's any wisdom that we can draw from the chimps and the societies that they have?
Well, they're so like ours that I think what it does is helps us better to understand ourselves. I mean, you know, they show emotions, happiness, sadness, fear, anger, grief. Mm. They definitely grieve. They have gestures the same as us, kissing, embracing, holding hands, patting one another, begging for food. They also, and I was horrified to find out, have a very dark, brutal side, and they can kill each other, kill individuals from a neighboring social group. And, of course, these are the kind of things that humans have done for as far back as we know. So, Louis Leakey sent me to study the chimps because he reckoned there was a common ancestor, ape-like, human-like, about 6 million years ago. That's what most people believe now. So he thought, well, if Jane sees behavior similar or the same in chimps today and humans today, maybe that was in that common ancestor. And he was fascinated in that because he was a paleontologist. He was searching for the remains of Stone Age people. And so he thought, this will help me to imagine how these people living so long ago might have behaved.
I want to read one more tweet, and this comes from Brooke, and it goes back to the beginning of our conversation. We were talking about how you know a good chimp mother from a poor chimp mother, and she wants to know, do chimp mothers discipline their young?
Yes, they do. They, when they're very young, and, you know, this is something I noticed and practiced with my own child a lot, no punishment. And I've seen human mothers, you know, when a little tiny child spills milk on the feeding tray and pokes around in their finger. Well, actually, the child is exploring. It's how they learn. And the mother will slap it. Well, it's okay to slap an older child who knows that you shouldn't spill milk all over your table. But for a little child of 1 and a half, so chimp mothers are really good at distracting their infants when they're doing something irritating, like trying to steal the mother's tool. So you see a mother chimp, and she's fishing for termites with one hand and tickling her infant with the other. And so, but if the infant goes, pushes her beyond her patience, they punish with a little bite on the hand. It doesn't break the skin, but it makes the child scream.
I'm thinking that story might resonate with a lot of parents, men and women, who are stuck working at home with children running around the house these days.
Yes. Distraction. We're trying to think of lots of new things to do for children. We're going to put out posts about that for these children who are stuck at home.
Well, actually, if somebody else tweets, Amanda tweets, have you ever considered doing fireside chats on a podcast or during this?
We just talking about it today.
Oh, really? Tell us more. What are you going to do?
Well, I know we're making a list of people who might agree to do such a fireside chat on a podcast.
What would that sound like? I mean, if you had a regular podcast or a regular message to get out to people, what would you want to communicate to people who would seek out your podcast?
Well, I think, I was thinking of the fireside chat. So it would be me and one other person. And you'd pick people who had interest in the different things that I'm interested in, you know, whether it's what we do about the wild animal trafficking or whether it's about childcare, comparing chimps and humans, climate change, those kind of things. And if you got interesting people, the conversation would be interesting.
Point us, if you would, quickly to another environmental or conservation leader, somebody who you might sit down for one of those chats who we should know about.
Well, one person that I try and sit down and chat with is Leonardo DiCaprio, because he really cares passionately about the environment. And I know him quite well, and I think it would attract a lot of people if he and I sat down and chatted. I don't know if he'd agree, but, you know, he might. David Attenborough might agree. And there's other people. We haven't made the list yet.
Well, I'm hoping that some of them are listening right now, and somebody's maybe Leo will call you right after this, because I think that I can imagine that millions of people would download that podcast, Jane Goodall. Thank you so much once again for spending time with us. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you too.
And please stay safe, all right?
Oh, yes, I'll stay as safe as I possibly can. Wash my hands a lot, keep my distance, no hugging, elbow bumping, and all the rest of it.
Okay, we'll elbow bump when we see you next time. Thanks again.
We will indeed.
Jane Goodall.
Namaste.
She's a global conservationist, founder of the Jane Goodall Institute and UN Messenger of Peace. Okay, think of the word cobalt. It's a striking shade of blue, an element on the periodic table, and at one point, a tricky goblin from German folklore. Over the centuries, science has given birth to words that are now part of our everyday life. Dinosaur, meme, vaccine. Yeah, we'll say more about vaccine in just a minute. I know that's on your mind. And when it comes to tracing back the story of where those words come from, who better than SciFry's resident word nerd, Johanna Mayer? She's host of the new Science Diction podcast. She's here to tell us the sordid tales of words like cobalt. Welcome back, Johanna.
Hey, John. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. So cobalt, there's a good story behind this word?
There is, and it starts in the 1500s with a bunch of miners in Germany and this one particularly pesky ore that was giving them a ton of trouble.
Okay.
So the thing that was going on is that, first of all, this ore, when they dug it up, it looked kind of like silver. It had this sort of metallic sheen on it, so they thought that they had great luck there. But when they melted it down, it was not silver at all. It turned out to be just a lumpy rock of whatever. So the second thing that was happening was that something in the ore was making these miners sick, and they just could not figure out what was going on. So the miners came up with their own explanation, which was as good as any other, which was it had to be a goblin in the ore that was making them sick. Naturally, of course. But the thing was, it wasn't just any goblin. the miners said that it was a particular kind of goblin from German folklore. And this goblin was called a kobold. That's with a K and with a D. And the kobold goblin had a reputation for being particularly troublesome and mischievous. So they were saying that it was this kobold goblin that was like stealing the silver out of the ore and making them sick. And it wasn't until 200 years later when a chemist came along and had a hunch that locked inside this pesky ore, there could be a valuable element isolated in it. So when he finally succeeded in isolating the element, he stuck with the miner's name and he called this new element cobalt with a C and a T.
Uh-huh. So I just have to ask, though, what was actually making them sick if it wasn't a goblin?
So it turns out that when cobalt is found in nature, it's combined with arsenic often. So that'll do it.
Oh, so that will do it. I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. All right. So tell us, Johanna, about this new podcast, Science Diction. Very exciting.
Yeah. Science Diction is a very nerdy new show all about words and
Shocking.
Science history. Yeah. So each episode looks at one particular word or phrase like cobalt and kind of digs into the science story behind it.
Excellent. So what are some of these other words that you're looking at?
So on the docket for the first season, we've got cobalt, meme, dinosaur, and like you mentioned earlier, vaccine.
Ah, very timely. Okay. So we've been hearing a lot about vaccines. Tell us the story of this word.
So for that one, you have to look back to the time of smallpox, which actually is a really ancient disease. I didn't know this before I started researching it, but there's evidence that pharaohs got it. And it was a totally devastating disease that people just couldn't figure out how to get rid of it. They tried everything from like herbal remedies to there's one record of a 17th century doctor prescribing 12 small bottles of beer in a day to try to get rid of smallpox.
Hold it. That actually sounds like an okay treatment.
I know. Maybe we should all try
it. Right. We'll try it. What the heck? I'll get back to you. Anyway.
Yeah. So they couldn't figure out what was going on until in the 18th century, this doctor named Edward Jenner came along. And Edward Jenner formally tested and documented this sort of hypothesis that had been floating around. And so the deal was there's this kind of apocryphal story that Edward Jenner overheard a milkmaid bragging about how she would never get a pockmarked face from smallpox because she had had this other disease called cowpox.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, here we go talking about another animal-borne disease.
Mm-hmm. But yeah,
cowpox and smallpox are both part of the same viral family. They just manifest differently. So smallpox, obviously, super serious. But cowpox, when it manifests in humans, not so bad. You just got some kind of like mild, but kind of nasty sores. And so for a quick biology recap, the idea was that cowpox and smallpox were from the same family. So once you get infected with the relatively mild cowpox, your body develops the defenses to kick it. And then once smallpox shows up, those same defenses are able to kick in and say, oh yeah, we recognize this and nip it in the bud. So Edward Jenner finally tested out this theory and he published his findings in a report called An Inquiry into the Causes and Effects of Variola Vaccini. And so here's the very nerdy etymology part of this story. In Latin, variola means pustules, and vaccini means essentially something that comes from a cow. So variola vaccini basically means cow pustules or cowpox.
Fun.
And that's the basis of the word vaccine. Yes, yeah, super fun. Lovely.
So hold it, but how did we start to use it more broadly than just about cowpox?
Right. So Louis Pasteur actually can take credit for that. He was the one who stretched the meaning beyond using cowpox to inoculate against smallpox.
Aha. So once again, thanks to Louis Pasteur. This is going to be a fascinating podcast. Where can people find out more information, Johanna?
You can subscribe to Science Diction wherever you get your podcasts. And we also want you to take a survey, if you can, at sciencefriday.com/diction survey. Tell us if you like the show.
Excellent. Johanna Mayer is host of Science Diction. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much, Johanna.
Thanks, John.
Charles Bergquist is our director, and our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Feather, and Kathleen Davis. We had technical and engineering help today from Paul Ruest. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of this program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. We want to assure listeners that we hear your concerns about coronavirus. We've put together a handy page on our website. You can find it at sciencefriday.com/coronavirusfacts. And on the Science Friday Vox Pop app, there's a lot more about coronavirus as well. I'm John Dankosky in New York.